Hello, this is Ian with the News Gazette. We'll be reading through 3 days' worth of editions today, those from Saturday, September 16th, Sunday, September 17th, and Monday, September 18th. We'll start today on the front page of the edition from Saturday, September 16th, with the article headlined "Scientist Laments U.S. Policy Reversals" from Julie Wirth of the News Gazette. Like other climate scientists, John Holdren braced for major change when President Donald Trump was sworn in last January. But Holdren, President Barack Obama's chief science technology advisor, didn't expect it to happen so fast. "They took down my office's website on the afternoon of the inauguration," said Holdren, former director of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, who will speak at the University of Illinois on Monday evening. Candidate Trump had made clear his lack of interest in climate change issues, and we didn't have much reason to be optimistic. But what has happened has pretty much exceeded our worst expectations," Holdren said in a phone interview on Friday. What has happened? A pledge to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accords, the removal of climate data from the Environmental Protection Agency's website, efforts to roll back federal support for weather observations, used to gather climate data, but also to forecast storms, and the appointment of cabinet officers at the Interior and Energy Departments, Office of Management and Budget, and the EPA who are climate change deniers, or weak and badly informed, he said. It's hardly surprising that these folks in the key leadership positions related to the environment and climate change, that a lot of bad things are happening, he said. Holdren's talk Monday kicks off a 3-day conference on building resilience to climate change by the UI Institute for Sustainability, Energy, and Environment. His premise is that society has three options to deal with climate changes that scientists say are caused by the buildup of carbon emissions in the atmosphere: mitigation, adaptation, and suffering. Policies based solely on mitigation, reducing emissions, planting more trees, and other steps to curb the pace and magnitude of climate change, won't be enough because it's already underway, he said. Society needs to adapt, or build resilience to, climate change. Building seawalls or wetlands to absorb stormwater, for example, or moving hospital generators to the roof from the basement so they don't lose power during floods. Developing crops that are more resistant to heat and drought, as UI researchers are doing. Changing building codes so houses and commercial structures aren't built in areas where they'll be inundated by sea level rise or flooded over and over during storms. You need enough mitigation to avoid a degree of climate change that's completely unmanageable, and you need enough adaptation to deal with the degree of climate change that's unavoidable, Holdren said. What's up for grabs is the future mix. What's up to us, in terms of the policies we devise and solutions we implement, is doing enough to minimize suffering, he said. There has been a fair amount of progress, Holdren said, pointing to steps taken by cities and counties in Florida to prevent storm damage. Florida Power and Light, a major utility in the state, has already invested $4 billion to increase the resilience of its electrical system against powerful storms. Whether or not you believe that climate change is making storms worse, these investments make sense because many parts of the country are vulnerable to storm damage or floods or other natural disasters, he said. As business people who can do arithmetic, they know they need to make investments. It's a little bit shocking that we haven't been making more investments in this domain all along, he said. Obama signed executive orders calling for revised flood standards to discourage building in flood zones and calling on all federal agencies to take climate change into account for every plan, budget, and grant program. But Trump reversed these orders. The good news is that many states and cities are determined to do the sensible thing whether the federal government is helping or not, he said. Holdren said there are signs Trump may revisit these decisions after the devastation wrought by Hurricanes Harvey and Irma, and may reconsider his proposal to cut funding for NASA's Earth observation satellites, which provide data and help forecasters pinpoint storms and save lives, as they did in Houston and Florida. Cutting off research support for Earth observations would be particularly damaging, he said, leaving a huge hole in climate data and our understanding of what's happening to the atmosphere, oceans, and the planet over time, he said. Trump has also proposed cutbacks in agricultural programs to make crops and farming practices more climate resilient, but states and individual farmers are interested in continuing these efforts, he said. One notable fact about the Paris Climate Agreement, the U.S. withdrawal won't technically take effect until after the November 2020 presidential election, Holdren said. So, a new president could say, we're back in. But in the meantime, a U.S. pledge to provide billions of dollars in assistance to developing countries to mitigate climate change presumably won't be honored, he said. And that's a big setback to the global effort. The United States is also surrendering its leadership in the shaping of future climate accords, he said. Holdren remains optimistic Congress will resist some of Trump's proposals, given its pushback on his plans to cut funding for the National Institutes of Health by $6 billion. What Trump has proposed is not necessarily destiny if Congress intervenes in sensible ways, he said. He also said polls showed that a sizable majority of Americans believe climate change is real and that humans have a lot to do with it. Most Americans also supported the Paris Agreement, he said. There's strong political support for action, he said, and that will continue to grow because the symptoms of climate change are worsening and because the cost of the solutions is falling, with solar energy and wind energy getting cheaper, he said. I'm hanging on to my optimism, he said. We'll continue now with the article, Score Win for Climatologists in Coal Ruling, in Cheyenne, Wyoming. Handing a major victory to environmentalists, a court cast doubt Friday on a long-standing U.S. government argument that blocking federal coal leasing won't affect climate change because the coal could simply be mined elsewhere. Environmentalists have been trying for years to block federal coal leases on climate change grounds with limited success. The ruling by 10th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals will require the U.S. Bureau of Land Management to provide more data to support its argument that coal makes no net contribution to climate change after it's burned in power plants. The BLM oversees leasing of vast western tracts that supply much of the nation's coal. This is big, and we're certainly going to be wielding this and using it to confront other mining approvals, both in the Powder River Basin and beyond, said Jeremy Nichols with Wild Earth Guardians. The Sierra Club and Wild Earth Guardians sued to block four leases that would allow mining to continue at the Black Thunder and North Antelope Rochelle mine, the two biggest in the country by production. Both are in the Powder River Basin, where vast, open-pit mines supply approximately 40% of the nation's coal. In analyzing the leases, the BLM found that burning the coal deposits would result in 382 million tons of carbon dioxide emissions annually, or about 6% of the U.S. total in 2008. But the BLM argued that because utilities could simply get their coal from mines that don't lease federal deposits, blocking the leases would have no net effect on climate change. The appeals court wasn't persuaded, ruling that the BLM didn't provide sufficient data to back up that argument. It told the lower court to seek more analysis from the agency. In the meantime, mining will continue at three of the contested leases the BLM sold to Peabody Energy and Arch Coal, the St. Louis-based companies that own the two mines. A fourth contested lease near Black Thunder hasn't sold yet. For some local news, we'll now continue with the column Tom's Mailbag, in which columnist Tom Kasich answers dozens of questions on the News Gazette website and provides a sampling in print. The first question, is there a final site diagram for the Champaign Central High School expansion? Earlier plans showed Lynn Street being closed between Hill and Church. That leaves a very, very long stretch of central Champaign with no north-south access. In fact, a quick look at the city map shows virtually nothing comparable in terms of isolating a stretch of four or five blocks. And what provisions are being made for staff and students who will be crossing Church Street in high numbers? Answer. We are in the design and planning phase of the Central Project, said Emily Schmidt, Director of Communications and Community Relations for the Champaign Public School District. As part of that process, we are discussing the plan for Lynn Street, as well as safe crossings all around the high school. We will be working closely with the City of Champaign on these items to ensure safety for students, staff, and the community at large. Next question. Do you know anything about two lots on Springfield and University that are fenced and seem to have pipes protruding from the ground and some partial construction? They are at Springfield and Locust, on the southeast corner, and University and Third, on the southwest corner. I thought maybe it was monitoring wells related to the American coal gas cleanup project we used to hear about, but that's a few blocks away. Answer. There are no monitoring wells that are far away from the American coal glass cleanup site, according to Champaign environmental engineer Eleanor Blockman. The Springfield and Locust pipes are utility markers for the buildings that were demolished several years ago, said Larry Happ, building safety supervisor for the city of Champaign. And the University and 3rd Street site, 209 East University, is a construction site for the long-awaited University Commons apartment complex, he said. A building permit application for University Commons was submitted on August 30th for a four-story building with commercial on the first floor and residential, 96 units, on the upper three floors. Construction is anticipated to begin in late September, he said. The owner of the development is listed as Dreamtown Properties of Urbana. Next question. What's the history behind the MASH character, Colonel Henry Blake, wearing an Illinois sweater? I was watching some MASH reruns the other day and was reminded that one of the characters, Lieutenant Colonel Henry Blake, wears an Illini sweater. What's the history behind this? I believe the character had a connection to the university, but I can't recall all of the details. Answer. Henry Blake, according to various episodes of the show, was from Bloomington, Illinois. Although Blake often wore an orange and blue eye sweater, only once, according to the site IFLN My Life, did he mention that he attended the University of Illinois. In real life, McLean Stevenson, who played Henry Blake in the TV show, was born in Bloomington, in McLean County, in 1927. He attended Northwestern University. He was a cousin of Adlai Stevenson, the former Illinois governor who ran for president in 1952 and 1956. Next question. I drive by a porta-potty business on my daily commute, and I recently started wondering how they dispose of their waste. Also, if they dispose of their waste down the sewer, how are they charged? Portable toilet waste should not be discharged to the sewers, said Rick Manner, executive director of the Urbana and Champaign Sanitary District. Instead, waste from portable toilets must be trucked to a sanitary district treatment plant. It is one of the trucked wastes that our treatment plants can treat, he said. We do have a higher rate for any wastes that have a higher concentration than normal sewage. Plant operators sample and report anything out of the ordinary, with the very real threat of cutting a company off for abuses, he said. In my previous employment, we cut off a landfill because of an unusual waste. It turns out they were previously at a cheese factory, and they had not cleaned their truck adequately between loads, so we got chunks of cheese and grease, Manner said. Incidentally, he added, we also accept mobile home and campers dumping during normal operating hours, but at no charge. Because if we were to charge, it would be more trouble than it's worth for us, and we don't want people to be encouraged to dump. And finally, a little more about a question from a few weeks ago about the construction to the north of the Salvation Army in Champaign. Major Tom McDonnell, the Corps officer of the Salvation Army Church at 502 North Prospect, said the homes that used to be north of the church have been razed and for now remain green space, but discussions are ongoing about turning the property into a community garden next spring, he said. We'll continue now on the front page of the Sunday, September 17th edition, with the article headlined, Watch Out Below, Best Solution to Viaduct Issues, Better Awareness, by Ben Zitterman, Champaign. A couple weeks ago, when a semi-trailer collided with the Springfield Avenue Viaduct, Isis Griffin could hear it in her popcorn shop next door. It was loud enough for us to hear even with our machines being on, said Griffin, one of the owners of Cool Bliss Popped Bliss Popcorn Shop. I can't remember if there's been a month where there hasn't been a truck that hasn't been struck. With Green Street under construction, much of the traffic has been diverted to Springfield Avenue, making this a particularly bad spot for trucked viaduct accidents. There have been 6 at the Springfield Viaduct this year, all since May 26th, up from 2 last year and 1 in 2015. Since the beginning of 2012, there have been 41 viaduct accidents, with 1 at Logan Street, 11 at Springfield, 14 at Washington Street, and 15 at Green Street. When trucks collide with the viaduct, it ties up traffic for hours. The one a couple weeks ago took about 2.5 hours to clear, according to Taylor Feldkamp, manager at Feldkamp's Towing, and that was a quick one because the truck was mostly empty. 3 hours is a short one, Feldkamp said. We've been there up to 6 hours. When it's fully loaded with produce, you have to unbox it, put it in another trailer. The driver may be issued a traffic citation, though Champaign Police Sergeant Thomas Frost said the driver's company is typically sent a bill for the damage and cleanup. Based on police reports of accidents that happened this year, the drivers in these crashes usually say they didn't notice the clearance signs. In one incident, the driver said he was unfamiliar with the area and was distracted when another car cut him off before the viaduct. In another, the driver said his GPS sent him under the Springfield Viaduct, and he didn't notice the problem until it was too late. Typical semi-trailers are 13 feet 6 inches tall, and the viaduct at Washington Street is only 10 foot 3 inches. At Springfield Avenue, only 11 foot 10 inches, and Green Street, only 11 feet 11 inches. Meanwhile, at the University Avenue Viaduct, where there hasn't been any collisions since 2012, there's 14 feet 3 inches of clearance. The driver needs to be trained on how not to get lost, said Sherry Jenkins, a truck driving instructor for 160 Driving Academy, who has logged 1.6 million accident-free miles. And if it says 12 feet 2 inches, don't go under it. Besides more training and paying attention, Jenkins said there are some other steps drivers, trucking companies, and municipalities could take to reduce the numbers of viaduct collisions. Drivers should use a GPS made specifically for truck driving, she said. Drivers have to use a truck driver GPS, not a car GPS, because low bridges are posted on that, she said. Rand McNally and Garmin both publish and sell truck driver GPSs. Most trucks use those. If they're smart, they do. Trucking companies also need to send their drivers better directions that avoid low viaducts, Jenkins said, especially since some drivers might not be familiar with the area. If there's a low bridge on that route, the company needs to send directions to come in from a different way, she said. She also encouraged municipalities to post more signs directing truckers to viaducts with enough clearance. Along Neal Street, signs already do this, noting the low clearance before reaching Springfield Avenue. And at the Washington and Green Street viaducts, flashing lights accompany the low clearance signs. The city doesn't own the road under the Springfield Avenue viaduct, since it's a state route. The Illinois Department of Transportation said it is looking into a low-cost improvements to reduce the number of accidents. At the Green Street Viaduct, there haven't been any accidents this year, since it's been under construction as part of the Multimodal Corridor Enhancement, or MCOR, project. This project will add 3 inches of clearance, still not tall enough for most trucks. It couldn't have been lowered any more than that, said Charles Sokolowski, assistant city engineer. Lowering the street any more would have resulted in significant impacts to large-diameter storm sewers leading to the Healy Street detention basin and other various underground utilities, such as sanitary sewer mains and water mains, he said. Canadian National, which owns the actual viaduct structures, did not respond to questions about the collisions. We'll continue now on the local page of the Sunday, September 17th paper with the article, "When's That Nursing Home Renaissance Coming?" from Tom Kasich. Now, the hope is when the turnaround begins at the Champaign County Nursing Home. A new management company is in place, vendor costs have been cut, employee headcount is down significantly, the search is on for payments long owed to the facility, a marketing director has been hired, and the plan is for a long census decline to be reversed. Soon. As recently as a year ago, the average daily census at the nursing home was 181. Today it hovers around 132, making it impossible for the facility to break even financially. In July, the nursing home's operation was about $169,000 in the red. It also owes more than $3.5 million to vendors and others, including about $1.9 million to Champaign County government itself. The institution's financial fortunes have been in decline for years, but they accelerated in 2016, when the county board began openly discussing the sale of the home. Then county board chair Patsy Petry even stated in a letter to Governor Bruce Grauner that she feared the home's financial condition was so dire, with millions owed it in late Medicare payments, that it was possible the home might have to be closed. That isn't going to happen, county officials insist. But the open discussion of a nursing home sale eventually became a question put on the April ballot countywide, where it passed with 54% of the vote. An accompanying request for a tax increase to subsidize the home failed. The census slide accelerated. While it had been 167 in February, it dropped to 155 in March and 141 in April. I think that, again, if you look at the census, when it dropped, that's when all the talk and things started, said Zan Koenig, head of the management firm that now operates the nursing home. The next crucial decision facing the county board and the nursing home is the facility's budget for the next year. Does the county board opt for a 6-month wind-down budget that anticipates a sale of the facility to a private operator in early 2018, or does it go for a 12-month status quo budget? That will be the topic of a special county board study session on September 28th. In the meantime, costs are being cut. The nursing home headcount, budgeted at about 215, is closing in on 160, said County Administrator Rick Schneider, and an effort is underway to gradually increase the census to about 144 in January and perhaps 155 by the end of 2018. We'll have some time to reevaluate whether those, revenue and cost-cutting, efforts are going to be effective before we get into the budget, which is scheduled for approval in November, Snyder said. I think there is an opportunity for growth that this facility has never seen before, Koenig told the county board last week. If their efforts are successful, the nursing home's revenue and expenses could break even. That would either make it attractive to a new operator, a broker hired by the county said the county would be able to get a minimum bid of $11 million for the facility, or could persuade the county's board to try and keep operating the nursing home as a public entity. That decision is coming soon. We'll continue now with the section, Top of the Morning, something to get you going today, courtesy of Jim Rosso. Endy Almanord typically spends Thanksgiving Day with family, at the dinner table, movie theater, and shopping mall. Not this year. The talented and spunky Champaign Central Senior will be front and center at the Macy's prestigious holiday parade in New York City. She was selected as drum major for Macy's Great American Marching Band, getting the good news from Marching Illini director Barry Hauser. Eventually. Seems Almanord missed Hauser's initial congratulatory email. Luckily, the Central Band performs at the Sweet Corn Festival every year, and this year, Hauser was a guest conductor, Almanord said. He told me the news in person right before we performed. I could not stop smiling. It was wonderful because all my friends are in the band, and they got to share the experience with me. My mother and sister were in the audience, so I made sure to tell them right away. There were definitely lots of happy tears. This has been something I could only dream of doing. I can hardly believe it has become a reality. Almanord's performance at the Smith-Walbridge Drum Major Camp in Charleston earned her a Thanksgiving Day invitation. She was chosen from a pool of about 400 students. Will nerves come into play? I have to admit, I have never actually seen the parade, she said. I am guilty of sleeping in whenever there is a break from school, so I'm not entirely sure of what I'm walking or marching into. But I know it'll be one of the greatest experiences of my life. We'll continue now, again with the Sunday edition, with the article, Farm Deal Has Deep Roots. 2006 Leasing Policy Dropped in Favor of Long-Term Stewards. From Julie Wirth. Farms donated to the University of Illinois generate more than $2 million each year for student scholarships, 4-H, Ellerton Park, or agricultural programs. Just who gets to farm them, and for how long, has been a sore subject with the state's farming community for the past decade. Now, some longtime critics are applauding a change in the way the U of I chooses operators for its 10,000 acres of farmland, one that favors long-term stewardship rather than the highest bidder. The university will no longer routinely open leases for bidding, allowing operators like Champaign County's Jeff Fisher to continue farming the land that was in his family for decades until the UI acquired it in the 1970s. It's long overdue, Fisher said. President Tim Killeen recently announced the fresh approach to a policy instituted in 2006 by UI trustees, who wanted to maximize the UI's profits from its farming operations. When that change occurred, it just upset a lot of people, said Chris Magnuson, spokesman for the Illinois Farm Bureau. I'd say there would be support for how this change is being made. Magnuson and others credit Kim Kidwell, Dean of the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences, since last November, for changing the process along with Chancellor Robert Jones. To their credit, they looked into it and thought it didn't serve the university well, Magnuson said. There was a lot of pushback. Before the 2006 policy was adopted, farms were run the way they had been since the UI acquired its first donated farmland in 1923. Farmers were given long-term leases and shared any costs, profits, and risks with the university. The idea was that farmland is a unique living asset, and the UI wanted to give farmers an incentive to manage it for the long haul rather than short-term gain, said Jonathan Norville, Director of Agricultural Property Services. If a farmer retired, or there was another natural break in that process, the UI would advertise the farm for rent, conduct interviews, and choose a new farmer, he said. But around 2005, former UI trustee Robert Vickery, who owned farmland, suggested putting the leases up for bid every few years. Vickery said he had noticed that UI's net per acre income was a fifth of what he was earning on his farms. We kind of had a meeting of raised eyebrows, he said Thursday. It seemed pretty logical to me that we needed to change this, and there was a lot of pushback. Trustees eventually approved the change over the objections of the Farm Bureau and farm managers at the College of Aces. The leases were put out for bid every 3 years, and some operators who had farmed UI land for generations lost out. In the initial round, 12 of 16 renewed their leases, with 3 submitting winning bids and 9 others matching the highest bidder. 4 declined. All but one of the bidders were from Illinois. Vickery noted that income went up substantially the first year, from about $1.8 million to $2.5 million, according to the UI, though corn and soybean prices were also on the rise. Income leveled off after that, he said, and last year totaled $2.27 million. Farming's a business, he said, noting that the Illinois Department of Natural Resources used the same approach. It's the only really straight-up way to do it. But Magnuson said the policy disrupted the traditional relationship between landowners and farmers that is designed to promote long-term sustainability and investment in the land. One was Fisher, who farms 156 acres next to Willard Airport in Savoy, which the UI acquired through eminent domain in the early 1970s to expand a runway. His grandparents, C.J. and Margaret Fisher, had owned the land since the 1930s. C.J. Fisher continued to farm it for the UI until he retired in the early 1980s when his son, Gary, took it over. When the university decided to move to cash rent bidding, Gary Fisher wanted no part of it and decided not to bid. But Jeff Fisher wanted to keep the family involved in the farm where he spent so much time as a child, working and playing in the barn and livestock buildings. So he matched the top bid and lost money on the operation. You get some ridiculously high bids that people can't possibly make a profit on, typically from larger operators who want to increase their acreage, he said. That was in 2008, and Fisher had to bid for it again in 2013. By then, the UI had moved to a more flexible arrangement, with rents fluctuating with farm prices, making it easier to keep the lease. Otherwise, I would have lost it, said Fisher, who farms a total of about 1,000 acres in Philo and Tolono townships. Robert Clem, who operates the 80-acre Campbell Farm for the UI near Waynesville in DeWitt County, was among those who eventually lost his lease. The UI land is next door to his property, and when he still farmed it, he installed a new drainage system that also ran through his land. But those kinds of improvements weren't considered when the university moved to the cash rent system in 2006, Clem said. It was strictly how much are you willing to pay in cash rent to be able to farm this land, he said. Clem and his son, who was just getting into farming, bid what they thought was an appropriate rent, enough to ensure a small profit, but they were substantially outbid by a large farm operator who lived outside the county. That also meant any income from the farm was removed from the local economy, Clem said. The larger operations, they buy their seed, fuel, and chemicals far away. The grain doesn't go to the local elevators, Clem said. It has an effect on the whole community. We'll now take a short break and return with the second half of the News Gazette for September 16th, 17th, and 18th. Please stay tuned.